Welcome to Stack Trace, the podcast where we talk about Apple news, rumors, technology, programming, and all sorts of things. With me, John Sundell, and my good friend from across the Atlantic Ocean, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Rambo?
Hi, John. I'm doing great here. How are you?
I'm doing great as well. I'm continuing to really enjoy writing articles now with using my new publishing format and the fact that I can just like come up with something that I want to write about, something that I've been using for a while, something that, you know, I think is good to share, and just write about it and publish it. Like, I don't have to worry, is it a Sunday? Is it a Monday? Is it a Friday? I can just publish whenever I want. And I know whenever I talk about these things, I sound silly in my own head because I know I could have done this all along because it's my own website. But it's just this new format kind of makes me feel more free to do stuff like that. And recently, I've been focusing more on sharing kind of Swift UI tips and tricks. So I've been kind of wrestling with myself in my head, if you will, about how am I going to approach kind of writing about Swift UI. I've written a lot of articles about it. I've done podcast episodes and things like that about it. But I've had a hard time like figuring out, should I write stuff that is more for kind of beginners or people who are just starting with Swift UI? Should I write more kind of documentation style content, like when I did the guide to the layout system and the guide to the state management system, which were more kind of, you know, guides and walkthroughs to a particular part or a particular API? Or should I do more kind of in-depth stuff and like how it works under the hood, like I've been exploring a little bit lately? Or should I do more kind of tips and tricks, right? And I figured that, you know, there's a lot of people writing about Swift UI right now, and there's definitely a huge demand for it. And I can notice that, like, every time I write about Swift UI, it, like, gets way more traffic than any other article I write. Even, like, if I might find the other topics just as interesting or even more interesting sometimes, there's just, like, just a huge demand for Swift UI articles right now. So I totally understand why so many people focus mostly on it, because there's the demand for it, right? So if there's the demand, there's going to be people who want to meet that demand. But I've kind of settled on that I think I want to focus more on these kind of tips and tricks, because Apple now also, I think they are investing more, it seems, in the documentation. They just released a whole bunch of new documentation around widgets and other modern APIs, which is really nice. And like I also mentioned, they're like the basic level is pretty well covered in the community in general. But kind of specific problems that are very commonly encountered when working with Swift UI, I feel like the answers to those are sometimes hard to find because it's such a new framework. And since I've been using Swift UI a lot now over the course of like over a year and now like working almost full time with it for the last couple of months, I feel like I have a lot of those answers because I've had to figure them out. So that's what I've been focused on lately. And I think it's a really nice format and just like lets me just answer a question real quickly, like get an article out there, help some people like who might be struggling with the same thing that I was struggling with. And it's basically like the things I wish I knew about sooner type of articles.
Yeah, I think those are the best types of articles. And those are articles I also love to write myself, not only to help others, but also to help myself. I think this probably happens a lot to you, where you'll end up coming across one of your pieces when searching something. I do have a few articles which are like that. Like I have one about sharing keychain between different targets, an app and extensions and things like that. And I do refer to that sometimes when I'm having some issues, like a checklist. Oh, did I see this? Did I check this? Because yeah, there are some things which are tricky and sometimes you only realize how to do things properly or at least as properly as possible once you've dealt with it for a while. So I think those are really great articles to be sharing.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also one of those things where you, as you start new projects, you will probably re-encounter those issues again, yep. Right? And like you said, like I sometimes do end up on my own website when I search for a problem, which is really funny when that happens. Yeah. It's funny and also frustrating at the same time.
Google is my documentation, basically, when it comes to Swift UI stuff.
Right. So it's definitely useful also when you're starting new projects and you can kind of refer back to that thing. It's kind of like a reminder for yourself in the future. And also now that I'm working with other people kind of on a regular basis as a team, it's nice also when I encounter something or I'm solving something in some way and they ask me, you know, can you explain more about this? I can send them a link to that article where I've explained it already. So that also makes sense for me kind of to, you know, again, build up like a little bit of a knowledge base, both for myself and for others, and for kind of the people in my team as well. So it's like the classic thing of, if I've faced this problem and if other people have as well, then the chance are that many people in the community have faced the same issue, and then it's worth writing about it. And another thing that a lot of people have actually asked me lately is, as I've been sharing these kind of tips and tricks, is how do I come up with this stuff? Like, how do I find these solutions? How do I come up with these APIs, or find these APIs and how to use them? And the answer is really, like, I just experiment a lot. And, you know, I might not do that while I'm working on a particular project, because when I'm doing that, I just want to solve the problem, want to implement this feature as soon as possible and get that shipped. But then I take note of these things, and then I go back to them and I try to experiment and refactor and change things and see if I can come up with a better way of implementing it. And if I do, then I change the original implementation and ship that again, or, you know, send a pull request. And I also try to write about it because, you know, again, if I went through that process of learning and experimenting and figuring it out, then it's probably worth sharing as well. So there's really no kind of secret formula, or like, Apple don't have like a secret developer website that only I can visit or something like that. It's all just like, you know, spending the time experimenting and figuring things out the kind of the hard way.
Yeah, I tend to do that when things start to hurt, you know, when you're doing some coding and doing a new feature or fixing something, and there's always something about that code that hurts you.
Right.
I recently came across a situation, and I haven't fixed yet, but I was doing some work in AirBuddy, and something I have to deal with quite a lot is Bluetooth addresses. But Bluetooth addresses can exist in multiple representations. They can be data, or they can also be strings, but the strings can be in a certain format when they come from Core Audio, but in a different format when they come from Core Bluetooth and things like that. So it's a whole bunch of messy conversion between different types of representations. And this hurts me a lot while working on that type of code. So I wrote down, like, create a type for Bluetooth addresses. Like, I need to create my own Bluetooth address type and normalize everything, because it's starting to hurt, basically. So yeah, that I do that a lot, and I do recommend it. And it's the same situation. Like, I didn't want to stop focusing on the goal that I had when I was working on, I think I was working on a new feature. So I didn't want to stop my flow working on that to fix this address thing. So I just wrote that down. And in my case, that was a GitHub issue that I created, because I also use GitHub issues for tech debt, basically. So that's what I did. And I highly recommend doing that and trying to stay focused. Like, don't stop what you're doing to fix the thing immediately when it's like a tech debt thing. Of course, it's important to fix it eventually, but just take notes of things that are hurting you in your code base and come back later.
Yeah, I think that's very good advice. And striking that balance between, you know, not moving too fast and ignoring all that tech debt, or ignoring those things that are maybe not implemented as good as they could be. And also on the other extreme, like, always getting really kind of slowed down by just focusing on all of the details and never getting anything shipped because you're just kind of like constantly refactoring. Like, striking a balance between those two extremes, I think, is really important. And whenever we talk about these things, like, there's this scout rule that people often mention, right? And I've mentioned it in the past, I'm sure you have as well, where it's like, if you're already working on a class or a function or whatever it might be, and you see something that could be cleaned up, then clean it up. Like, leave it in a better state than what you found it. And I think in general, like, that is good advice and is something I'm trying to follow. But it's also important not to kind of also take that too far, or kind of misunderstand that to say that, you know, for every feature you implement, or whenever you're working on something, you always have to be refactoring, because that can turn one simple task or something you could do quickly into like a huge task. And I see this very often happening, where you have this small little change that starts out as a simple pull request, and then, you know, the author just keeps adding to it, and it grows and it grows, and then all of a sudden you have changed like 2,000 lines. So I think, again, it's important to have that balance to say, yes, you should definitely adhere to the scout rule if you can, and leave things better than you found them. I think that's a good practice, but also, like, not making things overly complicated. Sometimes it's better to just do the thing you needed to do, take note of that tech debt or something you could improve, and then revisit it later rather than doing everything at once.
Yeah, that's something that used to happen quite a bit at the job. So I would go to review a pull request, and it will happen sometimes where I will look at the ticket that originated the work for that pull request, and it was like a simple task, but then the pull request had a lot of changes.
Yeah.
And I noticed that it was actually the fix for whatever the ticket was asking for, plus a bunch of refactoring. And my approach would always be to, okay, so let's isolate the fix, let's isolate the actual work. And not that refactoring is not work, but it is another type of work. So let's isolate the actual work for this particular issue, and then let's open a new issue for this tech debt that you're addressing here, and let's do another pull request, because sometimes it was going into a hotfix release, but you had all of this refactoring, and maybe it was covered by testing, or maybe it wasn't fully covered by testing. So it was just additional risk that was not necessary. So yeah, it is important to keep things organized.
Yeah, absolutely. Another thing that I see happening, and again, is something I've done myself in the past as well, is you get a comment on a pull request, and instead of just fixing that comment in that particular place, you also want to go and fix the same issue in other places of the code base that you might know about. So as a very concrete example, let's say that you are working with me and you use SwiftUI's AnyView, and everybody knows, well, not everybody maybe, but I'm not a big fan of SwiftUI's AnyView, and I'm trying to avoid it as much as I can. And I think that's a good recommendation. So if I see someone using AnyView and I know that there's a better way or a different way you could solve it, I would probably comment on that and say, you know, instead of using AnyView here, you could do this and this and this. And we'll have a link in the show notes to an article that goes into more details about that. Again, great to write articles about these things, right? So when you get that comment, you might then think that, okay, now I used AnyView also like 3 times yesterday in other places, I should go and fix those as well as part of this pull request. And that's when you start this kind of scope creeping, and you start kind of expanding this pull request way beyond the original intent, and that's when things start to go out of control, I think. So it's the same idea, like take note of it, go back to it, make a separate pull request or a separate issue, and work on it later rather than as part of the same pull request.
Awesome.
Cool. So that was a nice little discussion about refactoring and stuff like that. So Rambo, besides all of those things, what have you been up to lately?
Well, speaking of refactoring, I was today doing some fixes to AirBuddy. And not actual like bug fixes or anything. I was fixing warnings because
all right,
I don't have a strict no warning policy on my projects, especially the ones I work on for myself. But I do have a eventually clean up all the warnings policy. So I can have some warnings, but I need to address them. Just like with the refactoring stuff. I can have a few warnings here and there, but eventually I have to fix them. And during the craziness of V2 and all of the work I've done and new features and fixes and things like that, I ended up accumulating a bit of warning debt. And it was at around like 20-something warnings, and that was bothering me quite a bit. So I took Xcode 12.5, which we'll talk about a bit more later, as an excuse to stop a bit what I was working on and clean up the warnings in AirBuddy. And I am happy to say that after like 15 minutes of work, I was able to get it down to 0 warnings again.
Oh, fantastic. So can you give us a few examples on like how do you use warnings in your projects? Like, are these just kind of deprecation warnings or warnings from Apple or from the compiler? Or are they warnings that you've created yourself?
All of the above.
All right.
Yeah, so I had, I didn't have any outstanding warnings that I had written myself. I do put warnings myself for things like to-dos, one of those classic things we do. And I use the pound warning thing in Swift, so I can get like warnings about refactor this or change this once whatever issue is closed or something like that. I do that a little bit, but I didn't have any of those this time, but I had lots of those like weird, not weird, but like unusual warnings of things that are not immediately actionable, like linking against a dylib, which is not safe to use in application extensions. Like, I know what it means, but it's something that sometimes you can just check the allow app extension API, and sometimes you have to do a little bit more work. And I had that with a third-party framework, which was Paddle's framework, which is not open source, unfortunately. So I had to do a little bit of reworking where I link it and where the code that talks to it lives so that I would be able to eliminate that warning. I had some warnings in storyboards. I do use storyboards a little bit for my settings screen, so I also had to address those. But yeah, I also had some deprecations, but those were deprecations where I know the API is deprecated and I am using a deprecated API on purpose and there's no replacement for the deprecated API. That is more common when working on macOS than I would like it to be, unfortunately, but there are some APIs on macOS where there is just no replacement and you have to use a deprecated API. So in those cases, I just use the Clang diagnostics thing you can add so that I can ignore deprecation warnings for just that particular block of code.
Right.
Yeah, but that was basically it. So I am happy that I'm now warning free for a little while, at least.
Very nice. And do you have some specific kind of threshold or count or something like that when you decide, okay, now I have to stop and clean up these warnings, like in order for it to not go out of control?
I like to keep it below 10. So this was unusual for it to be above 20 in this case. But yeah, I'd say 10 at most, but ideally, before any given release, I will have zero, like before doing a release. And warnings are funny because it's like, I think that there are quite a few programmers who are like, oh, it's just a warning, right? Especially when you're just getting started. But
yeah, it works.
Yeah, but like a warning is something like if you're at some place and there's like an alarm saying, warning, fire. You're not going to say, oh, it's just a warning. Yeah, like it. Warnings are important. Clean up your warnings.
Exactly. So my threshold for these kinds of things, I call this the error filter threshold. So in Xcode, there's a little filter you can enable, which is to say, only give me the compiler errors here. Don't give me the warnings when you're compiling. And if you're at a point where you get some kind of build error, but you can't see it in the list because there are warnings covering it up, and it might sound now like there's going to be 100 of them. No, like there's around like 10 or 15 or something, like the same kind of number that you just mentioned. But then you feel the urge to click that filter button to say, just give me the errors. I don't want to see the warnings anymore. That's when you need to clean up your warnings.
So your threshold varies by display size.
Right, it does. It's display size dependent. But it's like that general feeling, you know? If it feels like the warnings are too overwhelming and you want to get rid of them because you can't focus with them there, then it's time to clean them up because it's way better to clean them up than to, you know, hide them, of course. So I tend to have the same thing, like around maybe like, you know, 5 to 15, something like that, warnings to before I start kind of cleaning them up. And, you know, software development is not this kind of, you know, precise thing that we sometimes like to think of it is, like where you always write code in your favorite way and it's always like clean interfaces everywhere and everything is great. Like, no, like we have to sometimes work faster and get something out of the door. Sometimes we don't have either the kind of knowledge to do something or we haven't decided how we want to do it. Like we want to postpone it to give us more time to kind of consider the problem before we decide how to approach it. And in all those kind of situations, I think that warnings is great as long as you go back and clean them up. Like, I definitely prefer warnings over the classic, like, to-do comments. And I know that you can use, like, SwiftLint and things like that to turn those comments into warnings, but I would rather just have them be warnings because that's what they are for me. Is if you have something you need to do, if it's really truly a to-do, then for me, that's a warning. And I use warnings kind of deliberately and often when I'm working to remind myself of something I want to fix maybe tomorrow or the day after or something like that. I try to clean up warnings kind of at the end of the day, like continuously. But if I don't have time to do that, or if I don't have time before a release or something like you mentioned, then, you know, I put them in there and I clean them up when I have time to do that. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think that's a great way to kind of just acknowledge to yourself that you're not going to be able to fix everything at once. It's, again, back to this refactoring discussion that we had earlier. Sometimes you need to postpone things for kind of pragmatic reasons, and that's fine as long as you kind of take note of it and go back to it later. And that's what I'm trying to do with warnings.
Yeah, like we mentioned before, I tend to prioritize shipping and development in the sense of the more design and more features and fixes rather than code correctness. And I think there are other types of developers who prefer to prioritize code correctness. And I'm not saying that I'm right and they're wrong. I think everyone has their own style and I'm fine with all of them. But I do think that there is a distinction between warnings and errors for a reason. Like, errors prevent your app from running, prevent your code from compiling, and warnings serve as a way to let you know that, hey, maybe you want to change this later. So they don't prevent you from going further. But yeah, try to keep them to a minimum, preferably close to or at zero.
Yeah. It also, of course, depends a lot on the team, right? Like, if I'm working with a team where there's like 100 developers, then I would not use the same approach as I'm doing right now.
Yeah, of course.
Because, you know, if you have a team where there's like 1,000 commits going into the main branch every day and like only 10% of those introduce warnings, then you have 100 new warnings every day. Like, that's not very realistic. That's not very sustainable. But if, you know, you're working with just like one or two or three or four other people, like I think most kind of smaller iOS teams tend to be that size, then this approach can work fine. Like, as long, again, as you have the discipline to go back and that you kind of foster that culture within your team, that it's not just one person who always has to go and fix everybody else's warnings. That's not fair or, you know, not very fun for that person. But as long as, like, everyone takes responsibility to kind of have, like, a cleanup Friday or something like that, where you all clean up the warnings and maybe fix some bugs and things like that. Like, you can use many different approaches, but I think being a little bit flexible, but still having the discipline and going back, I think that's kind of the balance that is good to strike.
Yeah, absolutely. Besides that, I'm still working on that sticker app we talked about, because, you know, iMessage is the future and the iMessage App Store is where it's at right now.
Of course, absolutely. It's making a big comeback, I've heard, in 2021.
So I'm developing one new feature, which is something that's been requested. And it was one of those things where I was like, how hard is this? Not how hard could it be and just do it, but how hard right. is it? Let me see how hard it is. And if it's not as hard as I think it is, then maybe I'll add it in. So someone requested that it be possible to remove the backgrounds of stickers in the app. So since you're going to be using photos from your photo library for as stickers, maybe you have some photo where if you could remove the backgrounds, like if it's, I don't know, there's a person making a face, but they're in front of a background, of course, because it's a picture, you would be able to remove the background. And I started doing a little bit of research into that. So at first I thought about the traditional, like, magic wand type solution where you select colors or you draw over a mat, basically, to create an alpha channel for a picture. But then I remembered that we're in this new era now and we have Core ML and machine learning and things like that. And I was able to find an image segmentation model, which Apple offers from their Core ML website. And what it does is basically similar to what the portrait camera does. It tries to find the foreground and it hands over a mat for you. And you can use that to mask an image. And I did some testing here and it is far from perfect, but it's more than good enough for small little stickers you're going to use on iMessage. So I think I'm probably going to ship this and it's going to be my first machine learning feature that I'm going to ship to production.
That's very exciting and a great use case of it too. And I think you're right. When you are creating something like a sticker, you don't really care that much about like image fidelity, right?
Yeah.
Like you're not creating like a professional billboard or, you know, something that's going to be included in a magazine. Like you are just sending something funny or something like that to your friend. So of course you want it to work reasonably well and not include too much noise or crop things that it shouldn't. But, you know, if it's not perfect, I think that's fine. And it sounds like a really great feature.
Yeah, and what's the most common use case for using a photo as a sticker, I think, would be to create like a personal sticker pack where like I take a bunch of pictures of me making funny faces and I use that as a sticker pack. And people are the subject that this CoreML model is best at identifying. So it's going to work well for most cases. But I actually tried it with like pets, like dogs and cats and things like that. And it does a pretty good job at all of them. And I think the main thing that helps here is that stickers are really tiny. Like they're 256 by 256 or something. So they're really small images. So by the time they become a sticker, they're so small that if the cutout is not perfect, it doesn't really matter. As long as it does a decent job at figuring out what the foreground is, it's going to work. And I was actually able to do some trickery with Core Image where I'm like feathering the mask a little bit in order to be able to get a better cutout instead of being all jagged. And I think I might even offer the user an option to like tweak the mask a little bit in the app if that doesn't become too complicated.
Very cool. Yeah, you can probably have like a slider or something. Like you mentioned Magic Wand earlier, and typically in Photoshop and Pixelmator and things like that, when you use those tools, you have like a slider of the intensity and you can toggle that to, you know, say, take more of the background or less of the background, for example. So if you could implement something like that, that it doesn't involve like 50 different knobs that you have to turn, right?
Yeah.
Because just like with Fusion Cast, like where you didn't want to build like a video editor, you probably don't want to build like a Pixelmator here as well.
Yeah, exactly.
So Rambo, it sounds like this app is really shaping up to becoming really nice, and I'm really looking forward to trying it out. I think maybe like on the next investors call, Tim Cook is going to say, the iMessage App Store is up 2,000%, and it's just because of this one application.
I hope so.
That'd be fantastic. All right, so now let's move on to our In the News segment. We have a lot of new things coming from Apple, new betas of iOS, and new Xcode versions to talk about. But before we do, let's take a very quick break to thank this episode's sponsor.
This week's episode of StackTrace is brought to you by Guardian Firewall, an advanced privacy and security tool for your iPhone and iPad. Download the app for free and get $10 off their pro tier at guardianapp.com/StackTrace. Guardian provides a safe and secure way to protect your privacy and data while using apps and browsing the web on your iOS device. When using Guardian, your IP address will be automatically hidden from any websites that you visit, which makes it much more difficult for advertisers and other trackers to identify and track you. It also keeps your passwords, financial information, and other sensitive data protected anywhere you go using AES 256 encryption, giving you an extra layer of security for your most important information. And Guardian also adds an extra layer of strong encryption to all of your outgoing network traffic so that you can browse the web and use apps safely and securely. As a StackTrace listener, you'll get a $10 discount on Guardian Firewall Pro, which gives you features like push notifications when your device attempts to connect to a tracker, a fast VPN service that protects what you do online, and a powerful firewall that blocks unwanted connections. Now, I've been using Guardian since its first beta version on my iPhone, and I love it. Not only do I get the peace of mind of knowing that what I do online is not being disclosed to my ISP or other devices on my network, but I also get great stats in the Guardian app showing all of the tracking attempts it has blocked, as well as detailed information about what has been blocked and why. So get started for free and claim that special $10 discount at guardianapp.com/stacktrace. When you use that link, you also directly help support this podcast. Once again, that's guardianapp.com/stacktrace to check out Guardian Firewall. Thanks a lot to Guardian for sponsoring this week's episode of Stacktrace.
All right, Rambo, so it's time to jump into the news. And of course, on this podcast, news means what has Apple been up to lately? So the first segment was, what have we been up to? And the second one is, what has Apple been up to? So Rambo, what has Apple been up to?
Well, Apple has released a new beta train. Everyone jump back on the beta train. It's the 14.5 beta for iOS. And this also means tvOS 14.5, watchOS 7.4. I never remember the watchOS number. And I don't know why, but watchOS always seems to be 0.1 behind everyone else. And also there's the HomePod beta, because that's a thing now. And the macOS one hasn't come out yet. Might be out by the time this episode is released, but there's a bunch of new stuff in this new iOS beta.
Yeah, it's really cool now that these point releases that Apple make typically in the spring, there's typically a pretty major point release, and sometimes during other parts of the year as well, like the one we're seeing right now. It's really nice to see like these point releases that are actual point releases, right? That are actually adding new features rather than just fixing bugs. Of course, fixing bugs is nice too, but it's nice to get these kind of smaller features spread out throughout the year rather than everything just being released at WWDC.
Yeah, and this started back in the iOS 11 days, I think, but it seems to have become even more prevalent recently. Like last year, we got all the cursor stuff on iPadOS. It was like 13.4, I think, or something like that. So yeah, this is really, really great. And one of the new features, which is really impressive, and I think no one was expecting, is that you can now use your Apple Watch as well as Face ID to unlock your iPhone while wearing a mask. So this is very specific. So the way this works is if you're wearing a mask and you try to unlock your iPhone, it's going to see that you're wearing a mask and it's going to use your Apple Watch to unlock your iPhone, which is great. Like, I really want that.
When I read this news, the first thing I did was take my Apple Watch out of the drawer it's been in for like 3 months and put it on the charger. So I haven't really been wearing my Apple Watch for a while because, you know, it's winter here. I'm mostly spending time indoors because of the pandemic, of course, and things like that. So I haven't really felt the motivation to wear the Apple Watch every day. So it started with just like I wore it a few times a week, and then I eventually just put it in a drawer and kind of forgot about it. So I'm really excited about this because I will definitely start wearing the Apple Watch because of this. It's going to be pretty big, like a pretty big improvement, especially when you are out and about. For example, like if you're in a grocery store and you just want to look at your shopping list or something, like fantastic to not have to, you know, unlock with your passcode.
Yeah, definitely. This is something that I'm sure was quite tricky to implement as well, because you can unlock your Apple Watch using your iPhone. So it's a bit of a loop there that I'm sure was fun to implement in a way that was secure. And this has all of the restrictions as when unlocking with your Mac, the Mac with your Apple Watch. So your Apple Watch must have a passcode, of course, and it has to be close to your iPhone and on your wrist. So, and it also requires the Face ID mask thing to trigger. So it's not like you can unlock your iPhone using your Apple Watch at any time. There's a bunch of things that have been added. And as far as I can see, this also only works for unlocking the iPhone. It doesn't work for payments or anything like that. So it makes the experience a lot better, I think, when you're wearing a mask.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't wait to try this. I think it's going to be really, really nice. This is like solving a really practical problem that I don't think any of us thought we would have like 2 years ago. But
yeah,
I think almost everyone has had this problem many, many times throughout the last year. So I'm really, really excited about this. And I'm sure it was not easy to do. But, you know, I'm glad they did.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if this has been in development since the pandemic started, basically.
Yeah.
But this is the sort of stuff that can take a really long time. Like, imagine the amount of QA and security checkups that have to be done in order to make sure that, first of all, this works, and second, that it works in a way that doesn't compromise the device that it's being used with.
Exactly. So how do you feel this affects this rumor that has been going on for a while that iPhones will eventually have multiple ways of authenticating, like with biometrics, that the iPhone would get both Face ID and Touch ID would also make a comeback? Do you feel like this affects that rumor at all, like that it becomes less likely perhaps?
I don't think so. I think, well, first of all, the team that worked on this probably doesn't know about the next iPhone.
Right.
But of course, they would need approval from higher ups, and they could say, oh, no, let's not do that. But second, I don't think this changes anything. Like, not everyone is going to have the iPhone 13 or whatever on day one. And that's only coming in like September. So there are quite a few months in between. I don't think, at least in my opinion, to me, this doesn't change anything. I still think it's possible that we'll see Touch ID on this year's iPhones.
All right. Yeah, I'm not really sure about this, to be honest. Like, I don't know whether or not it increases or decreases or keeps the likelihood the same of seeing Touch ID again, but I am really excited to see this feature at least. What else is new in iOS 14.5 that is kind of like a notable feature?
Well, I don't think you are on 5G yet, right? And I'm also not on 5G, but there is now dual SIM 5G support for the iPhone. So if you have one of the new iPhones and you have 5G, you can now have dual SIM, which was not possible before. But I'm pretty sure this was already announced, like that it would come with a software update. So here it is.
All right. Yeah, not very exciting for me, but I guess exciting if you need that kind of thing. I realize that, you know, there are different parts of the world where people use dual SIMs a lot. I've never used dual SIMs. Like, when I first moved to Poland, I still had my Swedish card. I guess I still do, but I never use it. But I had like a Swedish card and a Polish card, but now I just use the Polish one. But I never really felt like I needed to use them both at the same time.
Yeah, I use dual SIM while traveling, but I'm not traveling right now. But whenever I go back to traveling, I'm sure I'm going to be using it again. It was a really good experience using eSIM, so keeping my Brazilian SIM inside and using a NIP SIM for whatever country I was going to. That really helped and made the experience a lot better than having to like purchase a physical SIM and then being careful not to lose my SIM. I really like the feature, but yeah, not traveling right now and not using 5G, so not particularly interesting to me. But other interesting things that have been added to 14.5 were new financial health features in the wallet app, which are not visible yet, but this is something that was found by 9to5Mac inside the new beta, and also Apple Card Family, which also me and you, we don't have access to that yet, but it sounds interesting, like being able to share an Apple Card with family members and set their own limits and things like that. That's a feature I would expect from an Apple Card. What's your take on Apple Card, Jonah? Is it something that, like, if Apple introduced Apple Card in Poland, would you get it?
No, I don't think so. Maybe actually I would get it to get the points or to get the cash back on the Apple product. I guess that's how they get you, right?
Yeah, I will probably get it as well just because of the points, which end up being like a discount for Apple products in the end. So yeah, that's a nice feature, especially for me. Like, I'm always buying Apple stuff, so that would be really great. But yeah, some interesting features on this beta cycle, and I'm looking forward to using it. I'm using it on a test device here. But what's really cool about this new beta cycle is the new Xcode.
That is really, really cool. I think a lot of people were surprised to see just how many things that are in Xcode 12.5. And there's a bunch of new Swift features that are being shipped. Swift 5.4, not with async await, unfortunately. That's still hidden behind a compiler flag. But a lot of other great new features in Swift 5.4 are coming as part of this Xcode release. There's been a bunch of improvements also to kind of the compiler integration into the IDE. So you have like things like better autocomplete, better error messages once again, and things that they are continuing to iterate on and refine with every release. So a bunch of different kind of, you know, Swift features and general kind of developer ergonomic improvements in this release. And yeah, many other smaller tweaks and features as well, like kind of across the board. The release notes are quite long, and we'll put a link to them in the show notes as well. So I was really excited to see this. And again, it's a point release, and there's a fair amount of new things here to be excited about.
Yeah, definitely. I got really excited when I read the release notes because of all of the, especially all of the code completion related things and also some performance things. And when I tried the new Xcode out, I was able to confirm that it's true. Like code completion is really, really a lot better, in at least in the projects that I work with here. I mentioned to you before that like there seems to be a threshold after like 2 days of a new project when Xcode would just give up on code completion and syntax highlighting, yeah. And it doesn't seem to be the case anymore. Like I was having issues with the previous version of Xcode with this new app that I'm working with. Whenever I worked like 20 minutes nonstop with Xcode, I would have to relaunch it because code completion would just stop working altogether. And with this new beta, that hasn't happened yet, so I'm really happy about it.
Yeah, and with code completion, especially in Swift, it's a really complex problem to solve as well because of Swift's type system, like its generic capabilities, and also type inference. So when you have, especially when you have like overloaded methods and things like that, it can be tricky sometimes for the IDE to realize like what would you actually want to have in the autocomplete. And that's when we're seeing a lot where you will type something, you will type dot in order to access like a method or a property, and you will just get no completions because, like you said, it seems like Xcode has given up. Like it cannot resolve what type it is or, you know, what methods that are available for you in that context. And it's very, very common to see that when working with closures that I think a lot of us are doing now, especially if you're doing Swift UI or Combine and these kind of more modern Swift APIs that rely a lot on closures, where you will open up a closure, you will type like $0 to access the first argument, you type dot, and you will just get no completions.
Yeah.
And these types of situations, it feels like they're getting really improved, and I'm sure they're aware of it, and it's not an easy problem to solve. It's definitely not as easy as it might seem. So I'm really glad to see, like, in general, like, progress happening in this area, because it is kind of this hurdle that a lot of people face, especially when they start learning Swift or when they start, you know, making more advanced use of these features, that you kind of hit this threshold or this breaking point where it just stops working. And, you know, I've kind of, since I started doing Swift with Swift 1, where things were way worse than what they are now, I've kind of learned over the last few years to work without autocomplete. And that sounds terrible, right? Like, you don't want that. I definitely want autocomplete. But I see a lot of new developers who are not used to that, and I can't blame them. I mean, you should be able to rely on autocomplete. So that's been a kind of a big hurdle for people. So I'm really happy to see that it keeps getting better, and it's still kind of long ways to go to make it perfect, I think. But, you know, baby steps, right? Eventually, hopefully, we'll get there.
Yeah, and to be fair, like I understand that Swift is complex, and everything about that is true, but even for Objective-C code, Xcode's autocomplete is not always very accurate or available at all. So I do think that the work they've done for this release has really paid off in both languages, which I still write a bunch of Objective-C code every now and then. So I'm happy that it works better in both. But yeah, I'm generally very happy about this, and I hope that it keeps improving in the future.
Yeah, me too. All right, so next we are going to return to our deep dive segment, which we haven't done now for a few episodes, but we have a good one this episode about debugging. We're going to talk about our kind of general debugging process and how we work with those things. But before we do, let's take another quick break to thank this episode's second and final sponsor. This week's episode of Stack Trace is also brought to you by Kanji. Kanji is an Apple Device Management, or MDM, solution built exclusively for teams and organizations that use Apple devices. It's a modern cloud-based platform that lets you manage and secure your company's Macs, iPhones, iPads, and Apple TVs all centrally, which can save all sorts of IT teams countless of hours of having to repeatedly configure multiple devices manually. What sets Kanji apart from other services like it is that it has a strong focus on automations. It includes features like one-click compliance templates and over 150 pre-built automations, apps, and workflows. Combine that with Kanji's modern and intuitive user interface, which focuses on reducing the amount of time that it takes for IT teams to ensure that their Apple fleet is secure and efficient, and you've got a system that's loved by IT teams, both big and small, all around the world. Kanji, of course, also supports features like automated patching and app installs, both from the App Store and custom enterprise apps, managed macOS upgrades, security controls, a dedicated web API, and much more. And as an end user working at a company that uses Kanji, you will even get an app that gives you easy access to a select library of applications and tools so that you can download what you need when you need it without having to ask your IT department about it. So if your company is looking for a simpler way to manage your Apple devices, then check out Kanji today by using the link that's in the show notes, or if you're using a compatible podcast player, in the current chapter right now. Using that link also directly helps support Stacktrace as well. Thanks a lot to Kanji for sponsoring this week's episode of Stacktrace. All right, Rambo, so let's do a deep dive into debugging. So different developers, I feel like they have kind of different relationships to debugging. Some people, they really like kind of diving in and trying to figure out like how a bug happened and reproduce it and fix it and kind of seeing it a little bit as a solving a puzzle. And I think what is more common perhaps is that a lot of developers don't like debugging that much. They kind of see it as a chore, or, you know, they get these tickets in their bug management system and they have to, you know, figure it out, maybe sometimes on a deadline, and it gets kind of frustrating and sometimes you don't know what's going on. So I felt like it would be fun for us to just talk about this topic and to kind of share some tips on what our debugging process typically looks like, and kind of also talk about where we fall on that spectrum, if we enjoy debugging or we see it as a chore that we want to avoid as much as possible. Or how do you feel about these things?
Well, it depends on the nature of the bug. Like, there are certain types of bugs which are more fun to debug than others. And also depends a lot on what the report looks like. Sometimes you get these bug reports that don't have enough information to go about actually finding the bug. But I do what I call debug-driven development to some extent. And in this case, it's not really debugging a bug, but I will sometimes write a bunch of code in LLDB. Like, I'll pause my process at a specific point, and I'll, okay, what happens if I return this? What happens if I change that? And that's something you can do when you know the debugger and you know your way around LLDB, which took me quite a while to actually learn how to use, and it is definitely an important skill when going about debugging. But yeah, I'd say in general, I enjoy debugging. I wouldn't like to do just that for a living, but in general, I don't find it to be that big of a chore.
Yeah, I have the same thing, I think. And I think the key for me was to realize that, you know, when you get a bug report or something, it's not that you failed. Like, it's not something you should take personally. Because especially I feel like in the beginning, for a lot of people, when you get a bug reported on the work that you did, especially if you're like new at a job or something, it can kind of feel a little bit embarrassing, if you will, right? Where you're like, oh, I failed, I didn't account for this thing, and it's seen as something negative. And for me, the key was to realize that it's not really negative. It's just a natural part of the software development process. And just like before, when we talked about tech depth and these kinds of things and warnings, I also think that debugging is something that we have to kind of integrate into our kind of day-to-day process and day-to-day workflow as developers, where, you know, we can't just work on new features all the time, and we also probably can't just solve bugs all the time, because we also need to kind of move the product forward. So for me, it really becomes about like finding a good way to kind of fit it into my workflow, and also like trying to be pretty structured around how I debug things and how I approach something like a bug report in a more kind of organized way, to try to embrace that kind of detective mindset in order to figure out what's the underlying cause and how to fix it. That I feel like has been really key for me in order to both enjoy debugging and to kind of find a nice balance between debugging and feature development.
Yeah, and speaking of the detective mindset, I would say that the best types of bug reports are when you can interrogate the witness.
Right.
The best types of bug reports are when you can ask questions about the issue, because the person who's reporting the bug, they might be a developer, they might be some QA person, or they might be just a regular user, but they, regardless of who they are in that spectrum, they won't necessarily know the information that's important to you when trying to figure out what the problem is. So when you can ask questions back, that's really great. And unfortunately, in most cases, when you're working like for a company, you don't have that ability. The most you can do is like, if it's something that came from support, you can ask support to ask the user, and then this the question will change between you and support and the user, and you might receive a completely unrelated response back. So that can be a bit of a pain there, but of course that's something that a company needs to address in their process. But if it's like for an indie app or something like that, then it's all fine, because you can just talk to the user most of the time. I don't like when they come in the form of an app review in the App Store, because even right. though you can reply, the most you can do is just say, oh, please send us a report to this email or something. And sometimes the user will do that, sometimes they won't.
Can you please update your App Store review with a system diagnose?
Yeah, please attach a sys diagnose to your app review. But yeah, I like to be able to gather more information, because when it comes to these sorts of things, the more information, the best.
Absolutely. And I think it's really important to have information gathering as a distinct phase in your development workflow.
Yeah.
So it's very tempting when you get a bug report, if you have some kind of hunch or idea on how to fix it, it's very tempting to just jump into solution mode immediately. And of course, again, this depends on the bug. If it's a like layout issue where like this is 2 pixels to the right too much, then you can pretty much jump into solution mode straight away. I mean, sometimes it's tricky to fix those things too, but sometimes it's just you have to modify the constant on a constraint or something like that, right? But if it's a more like a trickier bug where you are not quite sure what's causing it, I think it's really important to give yourself that time to gather the information. Because one thing that I've done in the past, and I see a lot of people do as well, is that they jump to conclusions too quickly, and they start kind of blaming the bug on one piece of code, when in the end it turns out that it was a completely other piece of code that was kind of at fault or where the bug happened. And taking the time to kind of gather the evidence before you go to trial, I think that's really important. We're really like making bugs look like crime here, Rambo, here on this podcast. But it's really important to kind of gather all that information, I feel like, to get a good grasp of what's the situation. And only then I start jumping into the solution mode to kind of try to figure out a fix. But I feel like it can be really frustrating if you just immediately try to start fixing it, and then you might not know how to do that. And you try again and you try again. And at the end, you just try like a bunch of things and see what's going to work. It's usually better, I think, to be a little bit more organized about it and gather the information, and then you start trying to fix it.
Definitely, yeah. And one of the things that I would say is the thing where if you can achieve it, it's very likely that you'll be able to solve the bug in a reasonable time frame, is reproduction. So when you're able to reproduce the bug yourself as a developer, especially if it's while it's connected to Xcode, it's very likely that you'll be able to fix it, unless it's some like a weird obscure SDK bug, but even then you can usually work around them. So how do we go about finding out how to reproduce a bug ourselves?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And for me, this very much comes down to the process of elimination. To start out with, for example, the feature where the bug is manifesting itself in, which again might be a completely different part of the code base than where the bug actually is occurring or where the code is that causes the bug. The manifestation of it might be very, very different from, you know, the root cause. And yeah, that's again why it's so important to spend this time investigating before you start fixing, because otherwise you might also just patch the wrong thing. So I start with that feature where it's manifesting, and then I start just eliminating factors that I think are not causing or contributing to the problem. So then I dive deeper and I set breakpoints, for example, in different methods. I try to figure out what is called in what order. Sometimes I use print statements too, or LLDB, depending on, like, maybe if it's some asynchronous issue, putting a breakpoint in could actually fix the problem or make it worse, depending on what it is. So then I might resort to more like just using print statements and things like that to figure out, like, what order are things called in? How is the data passed around? What is the data look like when it goes through different layers? So when it passes from, for example, the network to your database, to your model layer, to your controller layer, to your view layer, what does the data look like in all those phases? And are there any changes that could contribute to the bug and so on? And I just keep doing that for a while. And now it might sound like this takes days, but this can all happen in the span of like 15 minutes,
yeah,
where I just, like, you know, continuously try to eliminate the things I think are not contributing and figuring out what are some of the suspects in this case to kind of see in more detail which one could be end up being like the place where the bug is actually occurring.
Yeah, and if you can't reproduce the bug, you can also start eliminating variables. So let's say you know the particular device the user was working with. So it's a bug that happened with a user on an iPhone 12 Pro. If you have access to an iPhone 12 Pro, run it on an iPhone 12 Pro and see if that changes anything. Also, the version of the OS, if it was on iOS 14.5, check 14.5 and see if it happens there. Of course, this is not always possible because you might not have access to a device, but you can also, if you have access to other users, so if it's one of my apps, for instance, and I can reproduce it, I might go on Twitter and say, hey, can someone run Chibi Studio on an iPhone 12 Pro and do this and see if this happens? there are ways for you to do that. And also, there are other environment type things that can change things in slight ways where weird bugs can happen, such as, is low power mode enabled? Is the device on really low battery? Is the device maybe on a slow internet connection? Maybe try using the network link conditioner, or try turning off Wi-Fi and using 4G to see if it changes something. Those types of things can also affect the way an app behaves.
Yeah, those are all really good tips, I think. And the network link conditioner especially is a gold mine for reproducing bugs, especially when it comes to these like network bound issues and things where it might be caused because of a slow network or something like that, or some kind of race condition. And I think in general, like, trying to reproduce the issue on like a real device in a normal environment, not in the simulator running on super fast Wi-Fi in the office, like trying to recreate conditions as they would be kind of quote unquote in the field, I think that is a good idea in general, because that will just give you more realistic information and things that you can use in order to kind of try to figure out those reproduction steps.
There's also a methodology, which sounds kind of funny to call it a methodology, but when you get some bug that is related to UI or some weird UI state, or maybe there's a crash and it's somewhere in UIKit or in your UI code, and you don't have specific reproduction steps, just start tapping random things and swiping randomly as fast as you can, and you'll usually trigger it, and then you'll figure out what you did that caused it. I had a bug like this in Chibi Studio. We had this weird crash that would happen with UI page view controller, and it was in iOS 13 dot something. So I had a device with that version of iOS and that version of Chibi Studio, and I couldn't for the life of me figure out what exactly was causing it. So I did this. I started like swiping randomly and tapping randomly, and I knew, of course, in which area of the app the crash was happening, but I didn't know exactly what triggered it. So I just did that, and I found out that it was like, if you just tapped a category item which makes it so the page view controller navigates ahead to a category, but at the same time you swipe back, it would crash, and it would crash deep inside UI page view controller, and I had to figure out a workaround for that because it was a crash inside UIKit. That's the type of stuff you have to do sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. when there are no other options.
Yeah.
Also, rotation can also help trigger some of those bugs as well, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, especially if you have layout issues or constraint issues and things like that. If you rotate a device, you are basically triggering a real layout, and that could also help surface some of those bugs. And navigation, like you say, as well. Like, navigating to a screen, then going back and going back and forth, that can also help trigger some of those things. But in general, of course, it's always the easiest if you have some kind of reproduction step or a stack trace, like the show is called, then that also really helps. But even if you have all of this information, I think it's still important to go through those steps that we talked about earlier to like not jump too quickly to conclusions, because even if the bug looks like it's in UIKit, and the bug might be like the crash itself might actually happen inside of UIKit, that doesn't mean that we can just say, oh, it's a UIKit bug, so we can't fix it. Like, yeah, it might be our use of UIKit or how we call it that is actually triggering that bug, and then we can work around that or fix that somehow. And this is very common when working with things like, for example, UI collection view or UI table view that are more kind of advanced views, or UI page controller, like you said as well, where something might be wrong in how you're supplying your data to those views rather than it just being like a SDK bug.
Yeah, that's like the last option. You should never assume it's a bug in the SDK. You should always assume it's your fault. And in most cases, it will be very clear. It will say like, oh, you attempted to insert a row, but you can't insert a row because the section whatever doesn't exist or something like that. That's a very actionable error exception that it pretty much indicates that it's your fault. But just to be clear, in my case, it was in fact a bug in UIKit. But that was like after I spent probably like 5 hours working on that bug. And then I finally gave up, and like I wrote, and this is also a really good thing you can do. If it is something weird where you're not sure if it's in the SDK or not, if possible, create a sample project, like create a separate project and try to replicate the problem there. And many times, and this has happened like many, many, many times, I was ready to send a feedback to Apple with a sample project, but in the process of creating a sample project and isolating the problem, I figure out that it wasn't a problem in the SDK, and it was actually my usage of the SDK.
Yeah, it goes back to that kind of process of elimination, right? Then you're eliminating like the SDK itself from the equation. I mean, you're not eliminating it because you're still using it, but you're using it now in a different environment. So I guess you've eliminated your own code in that sense, but that means that you know that in your code is where the problem is. So I think that is super valuable to do that as well. And related to that, one other tool that I use a lot when it comes to fixing bugs, and I think I mentioned this before on this podcast, but it's to use unit tests, because it's another kind of different environment that you can execute your code in to also help you eliminate or figure out like what can actually be the issue here. So I can create an instance, for example, of my object and call the method that I suspect might be at fault, try to give it some different arguments and write some assertions. And usually then I can trigger the bug somehow, or I can at least have like an idea of what might be the problem. And then once I have those reproduction steps and I am confident in what the issue is, then I can write a test that verifies my eventual fix. And then I'm kind of doing like almost like test-driven development where I have that failing test and then I go ahead and implement a fix. And then I also have a very concrete verification of when I fix the bug because the test will start to pass. And then I also have a test that verifies that I fixed the issue now and hopefully it won't happen in the future either because of that test. So yeah, I feel like that's in general like a pretty nice tool to use as well when bug fixing and debugging.
Yeah, absolutely. And that also guarantees, or at least guarantees to some extent, that you won't have regressions, that by changing something later, you won't reintroduce that bug.
Exactly. And that's also really useful when it comes to like SDK hacks, if you will, like when you have to like work around something in UIKit or something like that. And maybe you're making some assumptions about a certain subview being there that you have to modify or something like that. Then writing a test also that verifies that, for example, make sure that subview that you assume is there is actually there, can also help you like give you a good indication if that ever changes in the future release. You can get that indication through your unit test so that you don't have to spend days like trying to figure out why your UI doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. So that was a very nice deep dive, I think. And let us know if you have any follow-up questions about our way of debugging things, like how we use some of these tools in more detail. If you want to learn more about that, then let us know. You can always tweet with a hashtag AskStackTrace to ask us questions for the show, or you can email us at stacktrace@9to5mac.com. Thanks a lot also to this episode's two sponsors, Kanji and Guardian. Make sure to check them out as well, as that really helps support this podcast. But most of all, thank you so much for listening, everybody. And say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.